Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. Today was the first day of our coverage of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology annual conference here in the Westin Bonaventure Hotel, Los Angeles. The SVP were formed in 1940 by 34 paleontologists. The society now has more than 2,300 members, representing professionals, students, artists, preparators, and others interested in vertebrate paleontology. It is organised exclusively for the educational and scientific purposes, with the object of advancing the science of vertebrate paleontology. At this event, we're aiming to continue our daily reports, following on from our coverage of GSA, and I hope you've been enjoying them so far. SVP has a narrower focus than GSA, and so it's been a lot easier to find researchers to interview and people you know. So, fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on your viewpoint, I managed to team up with John for this entire event. As always, we'd love to see your comments and views on each episode, and hopefully we'll get plenty of material for all you vertebrate lovers out there.
So I'm Octavio Mateus, a paleontologist at Universidade Nova de Lisboa and Museum of Lourinhã. We have embryos, eggs and embryos of Torvosaurus. Torvosaurus is the largest land predator in the Jurassic. It's somewhat similar to T-Rex, but much more primitive. And also a large theropod, and the skull is like 1.5 meters long, and we have these embryos, these eggs with embryos, which is quite remarkable, and by the first time on such a large animal, and being a late Jurassic on age is one of the oldest embryos ever. This goes together with Lourinhanosaurus embryos, also a theropod. So in Lourinhan, it seems to be one of the best places, if not the best place in the world, for studying late Jurassic eggs and embryos. And so this tells about ontogeny and how do they reproduce, how do they lay eggs, and so on.
So is there a geological reason why you're getting so many nest sites, would it be?
Well, clearly that place were good for the animals to live and to die, and they were was good for getting covered, so fossilized, and definitely now it's all that sediments are outcrop at the surface, so it's easy to find them. Why we don't have that many in the Morrison Formation, that's what's it's puzzling. I mean, Morrison Formation goes from Canada to New Mexico, and ours is just like 50 kilometers. The comparison is crazy. I mean, the difference in size, and we in Portugal have so much more than here in the Morrison Formation in the United States. Why is that? We don't know yet. But by the first time presented here, we have theropod embryos from Allosaurus from the Morrison Formation. And then we can compare with the ones in Portugal and the ones elsewhere, and finally understand more about the ontogeny of dinosaurs. We keep finding, we do some studies on Morrison fauna, and we recently named a new diplodocid called Caetidocus sibirai. So there are many more sauropods to be unearthed from the Morrison Formation than previously thought. That's valid for diplodocids and camarasaurids.
Do you need any more volunteers in Lourinhã?
We always take volunteers. So if you want to do paleontology, if you want to get your hands on and grab true dinosaur fossils, come to Portugal. You are very welcome to join us in our excavations.
And that's something I have personally done.
Yes, you have been a very nice paleontologist, a very nice volunteer there, and it's interesting to see now that many many people that by the first time when they work on dinosaur fossils was with us, and now they become famous paleontologists.
Such
or
as
reporters.
Myself. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
So we're here now with Rebecca Hunt-Foster of the Bureau of Land Management, and she's got a poster on the paleofauna of the Williams Fork Formation, northwestern Colorado, coastal deltaic deposits dominated by freshwater taxa.
You know, you don't have to read out the whole thing, Dave. A general gist will do.
So it sounds to me like you're getting a lot of animals being washed into this coastal area. Is this what's happening?
We get a little bit of animals being washed in, but it's a lot of just representation of what actually lives in the area and the animals that are present, other than just the dinosaurs.
Okay, so what kind of animals are you getting?
We're getting everything from lizards and little multi-tuberculates to big hadrosaurs and ceratopsians and theropods. So you're kind of getting a wide smather. Also, you know, you'll have fish and crocodiles and champsosaurs and things like that.
So you're able to separate out all of the taxa and work out which ones from where. Do you have any way of doing that? Any methodology of being able to tell what's from upland areas and what's living in situ?
Not so much yet. All this stuff seems to not have been transported very far, so it all seems to be pretty close to home, pretty close to being found in place.
Okay, and how complete an assemblage do you think you're getting?
As far as an environmental picture, I'd say we're getting a pretty good picture of the fauna, what all would have lived in the area. It's probably not complete, but I'd say we're getting there.
So how are these fragmentary remains actually changing our view of dinosaurs around this time, or vertebrate forms around this time? Are we doing anything to, you know, of a new species coming out? Or
they might be.
So it's preliminary.
So, I mean, if you look at kind of where the age of this compared to other things, it's a little bit towards the end of the Caparowitz, just a little bit younger than the Caparowitz fauna. And so you really don't get too much in this area from that age, other until you get down in the San Juan Basin or further up into Montana. So it's kind of filling in that intermediate picture of what's going on between your northern Montana, Alberta faunas, and then your southern stuff down in San Juan Basin and the Caparowitz and things like that.
What's the most interesting thing you found so far?
I can't tell you.
Ooh. But you're at a conference. You're supposed to be telling us stuff. That's the whole point about this. We're the exclusive scoopers.
Tune in soon.
Okay. Excellent. In that case, we won't tell you our super secret thing either.
So there.
Yeah. Come back 2 years.
Cool. There we are. All good.
Cool.
So I'm looking here at a poster about Lystrosaurus from the Triassic Karoo Basin. Could you tell us who you are and what you've been looking at, please?
Hi, my name's Pia Vigliesi, and basically I've been working on a fossil comprising of 9 Lystrosaurus in a bone bed. So Lystrosaurus was a therapsid or mammal-like reptile that survived the mother of all mass extinctions, the end Permian extinction event, where 70% of land animals went extinct. But Lystrosaurus was one of these rare survivors, but clearly something in the environment was not always good because they were dying en masse in these bone beds. So I was testing a hypothesis that possibly they were dying in these droughts because the climate got warmer and drier during the end Permian extinction. But what I actually found after doing some stable isotope work on some carbonate nodules associated with the bone bed was that the climate was possibly seasonal, but also possibly seasonally cool. So I came up with another potential theory on the origin, is that maybe these animals were grouping together as a means to thermoregulate or keep warm during seasonally cold conditions, be it during changes during daily temperatures or seasonal temperatures.
So how is it that you think that these Lystrosauruses died together in situ? Couldn't it have been the case that they were all washed together in a kind of fluvial environment or something like that? Have you got any evidence to say that they are there and that they all died together at the same time?
Okay, well, first of all, the bone beds in very fine-grained mudstones, so that implies the energy was very low during deposition. We could argue that the animals were carried in floodwaters and then very kind of passively settled on the floodplain, but we find they're all one species, and they're all a similar age. They're all subadult from the sizes of the skulls. So you would expect maybe other animals from the floodplain that had died in the drought to just be washed together, and there would be maybe some other animals associated. What we also find is in the bones themselves, there's no evidence for water kind of carrying them, because the bones aren't orientated in a particular direction. And we also find what I've called associated disarticulation. So basically, we have limb bones that you can see the bones were, they formed that same limb bone or leg, but the bones are just lying next to each other, disarticulated, but still together. So that means they weren't disturbed much during the process of the skeleton becoming disarticulated. So this implies that maybe, because they're all the same age animal as well, that maybe they were grouping behaviorally together, and they were together before death. I'll also say that there has been in the literature evidence of other dicynodonts. Lystrosaurus is a dicynodont, and we found in China and in Zambia and also Brazil evidence of young dicynodont species showing grouping behavior in other fossils. So, thank you for listening.
So we're here with Lovisa Rettman from the University of Uppsala, and she's got a cool looking poster on giant fish and their phylogeny and paleobiogeography. That's a toughie. They're a group called Pachycormiforms. So hi Lovisa, what's the dealio with your research?
So this poster that I'm presenting here at SVP is about the most basal genus of the filter-feeding clade that is called Pachycormus. And I'm revising that genus because the features that the three different species that are that belong to this genus, they're a bit dodgy. They don't really make any sense. And also, there's a holotype of one of the species that is missing. So I revised it.
Cool. And what's so kind of important about these things? So there were filter feeders?
So within the Pachycormiforms, there is a filter feeding clade. And within these clade, like the biggest bony fishes ever alive arose, but they lived in the Cretaceous, and some of them were up to 13 meters long.
So that's a big barbecue fish. Were they around at like the same time as whales or anything like that, or was that way after?
Yeah, you're right. So when they got extinct in the end Cretaceous, after that, other filter feeding animals like the whales, the filter-feeding whales, and the basking shark, they took over their niche.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks very much for explaining your research to us. Good luck. So we're here now with Thomas Halliday from UCL in London. He's got a wicked-looking poster here on the timing of a diversification of placental mammals through the Paleocene, so that's just after the Cretaceous mass extinction. First of all, what's a placental mammal for people like me who don't know?
So the living groups of mammals, you can divide it into three main groups. There's the monotremes, which are platypuses and echidnas. They're the ones that lay eggs. We've got marsupials like kangaroos and koalas and wombats, and they're the ones that breed using pouches. And then there's placental mammals, which is pretty much every other living kind of mammal that you can think of, from a whale to an elephant to a mouse to us.
Oh, okay, cool. So they're pretty diverse then?
Absolutely.
Awesome stuff. So you've got a pretty impressive looking phylogenetic tree on your poster here. So what have you discovered? So what do you know about their diversity?
There's been some debate in the literature about when placental mammals actually originated. Morphologists, so paleontologists like us, have usually said that the origination of placental mammals happened after the dinosaurs go extinct. They leave this wide open ecosystem for mammals to exploit all of the different niches. Whereas if you take molecular data, so DNA rates and protein and RNA and so on, the dates that have come out have tended to be far, far back, almost double the age, often about 120 million years as opposed to 65. So what this is trying to do is taking into account a lot of the very strange mammals that live during the Paleocene, which have sort of tended to be ignored precisely because they are very unusual in terms of their morphology. And what this is essentially showing is that if you take into account all of the mammals that are in existence just after the end Cretaceous mass extinction, that is when the radiation appears to be happening.
All right, cool. So the story's just got a whole lot more complex. So is this what they call like an adaptive radiation?
Absolutely. Yeah. So prior to the end Cretaceous, all mammals, for the most part, they live in the trees. They're kind of shrew-like, they insect. Whereas afterwards, you suddenly get a big appearance of large-bodied herbivores and also associated with that, large carnivores. You get aquatic forms, and eventually you get flying things in the form of bats. So this is absolutely an adaptive radiation of one of the biggest, I would say, in the history of life.
We're now joined by Matthew Boards from Stony Brook University, who co-hosts the Pastime podcast. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing very well. Yeah. It's the American paleontology podcast.
So how are you enjoying the conference?
I always think that I know what I'm going to see, especially from reading the abstracts, and then like come in when I actually see what the methods are, then like start adding more stuff to the toolkit that I just makes my dissertation take longer, ultimately. But it's day one. I've also been furiously working on my presentation. So once that's gone, I'll enjoy it even more.
So what are you actually researching?
So I study a group of animals called creodonts, which were the carnivorous mammals that were around before dogs, cats, and bears took over. Like, they were 45 million years, kind of the top dogs. But they were especially, like, they were the only carnivorous mammals in Africa for 45 million years. And so I'm working basically on the systematics of creodonts, so I can then ask ecological questions about carnivory and why they ultimately went extinct and why dogs, cats, and bears took over. So that's my dig. Big pointy teeth.
So have you not brought your equipment with you?
Well, my equipment is my phone.
Is it?
Yeah. We're working on getting slightly more technological support for what we do.
Hand record H4N from Zoom, I would recommend.
I was going to say, I'm appreciating what you have in hand. You got a press badge, too. That's awesome.
Yeah, I got in for free.
Nice. Dang it, really?
Although I do have to do a lot of work for this. Okay. A lot of editing.
Yeah. Because you got them coming out daily, right?
Yeah.
That's more than we were able to handle.
So are you doing a special from here?
We'll do one kind of post-hoc.
After a report.
Yeah. Kind of like do a wrap-up as we banter. But I don't know, maybe you'll inspire us to try and do one. Because if they can, we can.
And for our audience, where should they find this?
You can find us at www.pastime.org, or just search Pastime Paleo and you'll find us. And there's plenty of time for everybody. Tune in and listen to what we're talking about.
So we've had me on the Paleo After Dark podcast. We've come across Darren Naish from Tetsu podcast. And now Matthew Boards from Pastime. So that's 4 out of 4 that you've had
exactly.
Now.
There it is. The Grand Slam.
So exhibiting here today are some of the guys from Bone Clones, and they have quite a lot of replicas here with them and quite a lot of different sizes and a variety of animals. Could you tell us about who you sell to, how the casts are made?
We sell to educators. You know, it could range all over Europe, well, worldwide, really. So how we make them is we start with an original piece. We make our molds of it. We generally have to prep for molds. And then we'll make casts, we'll pour the casts, we'll ship them all over the world. Whatever people want.
So do you have problems getting hold of specimens to copy that are in museums, for example, on display, or that are really rare or valuable? Do people let you make copies of them?
Well, we'll start with someone who wants a copy of it, and they want the copies to send to colleagues or such. So it's really not that tough. Of course, there's pieces we want that we cannot get a hold of, but more than not, they come to us.
How accurate can you get a copy?
It's very accurate. It's analog, basically. So anything that's on the original, we could come up with our silicone.
So it can be used for research as well, then?
Well, we always say that you should always use originals to research. So ours are good for ideas or relationships. But if you want to do research, use the real.
So what are these actually made from? Are they plaster or plastics?
They are polyurethane resin. So that way they go into the mold. The resin we use get very detailed information. So it's virtually, I wouldn't say it's unbreakable because I could break anything. But they're pretty durable.
And what kind of animals or what kind of organisms have you made copies of? What's the biggest, smallest, your favorite?
Well, the biggest is our cave bear, our short-faced bear, rather. And as you see it in here, the ceiling's probably, what would you say, about 10 feet. So it's quite an astonishing large item. There's other places that make bigger than us, but we try to concentrate on a little bit smaller so we could get fine detail. And the smallest, well,
one of our small primate skulls.
Maybe a vampire bat.
Yeah.
So fairly tiny.
And if people want to look at some of the materials you're producing, have you got a website?
Yeah, boneclones.com.
And can they buy from there?
It's on Twitter. You could buy from the website as well.
Great, guys. Thanks very much.
Now we're here with Christina Bird, who has another awesome-looking poster on ontogeny and plesiosaurs. So we heard a bit about that earlier. So hi, Christina. This looks cool. Did you find these fossils yourself? Or?
No, actually this whole specimen was found probably about 30-some years ago. It got sat in storage. It probably went on display at some point. That history is a little bit lost, but somehow I found it to my advisor's paleontology lab. He wanted a student to study it. I was like, I'm game.
Awesome.
Sweet. So I got my hands on this, decided, let's go to work. He needed somebody to describe it and work on some questions on it. So that's what I did.
For the non-vertebrate paleo guys, what actually is a plesiosaur and polycotylid type in particular? So these guys are weird, right?
A little weird. Plesiosaurs are typically known as the long-necked, four-flippered marine reptiles that lived back during the age of dinosaurs. Polycotylid plesiosaurs are a short-necked variety of plesiosaurs. So often it gets called a pliosaur, but it's not. But I won't go into all those details.
Cool. So it's just like a non-adult specimen, so a juvenile or something.
Yeah. So this is a very young juvenile. It's very small. It's probably only about 2 meters long.
Oh.
The adult form for these guys was probably closer to 5 meters.
Okay. Cool. So what does it show? Do you see what do you see change then with these guys as they grow up?
As they grow, what we're seeing is in several of the bones, a very big morphology change. So the overall shape of the bone is changing. And it's most drastically seen in the scapula and the ischia, where the scapula is in the really early on stages, it's missing this anterior process.
Okay.
So it would go from the shoulders and extend towards the center of the body. And in the ischia, it extends back towards the tail, so it's getting longer and longer. And it's really drastic, so when you look at the juvenile versus the adult, you're like, is that really the scapula?
Oh, wow.
Are you sure that ischia is not a scapula? It's like, what's going on? So there's some really drastic changes happening and some interesting features with the shape difference. Because with the juvenile forms, you have a really thin edge. This is like, what's that thin edge about? You get a thin edge, then it gets thicker. What? So this led into some other ideas that I had for some later conclusions outside of the quantitative work that I did, trying to look at the allometry. So does it grow wider or longer, or does it stay the same shape, which is isometry?
So does it kind of have a, oh, the shape change, does it have any kind of functional implication? So did it change the way it swam or anything perhaps? Or is that difficult?
Potentially, it is a hard question to answer because there's not very many young specimens like this one. Really, there's only two that are relatively the same age stage. There's one at the LACM and there's my specimen that I studied here. Functionally, there probably is a difference, but also going into function is we see this bone, but there was probably also cartilage attached onto that thin edge of the bone. But how much cartilage was there? I don't know. I wish I knew. If I knew more about how to measure the physiology of figuring out that extension, I would do it.
Could you do that by like chopping up dolphins or something? I mean, not very environmentally friendly, but...
Unfortunately, there are no modern analogs, okay. So I guess that's kind of fortunate because then we don't have to chop up anything. But it is unfortunate because now we have to really do a lot of tests and figure out how these things swim to begin with, which hydrodynamic studies have been done for several years, and we're still trying to figure it out.
All right.
One of my lab mates was studying hydrodynamics in plesiosaurs. So it's still a question of trying to understand the adults and how they swam, let alone trying to understand the juveniles and how they swam. So it's still kind of a mystery, but we're slowly checking off the box, trying to get a little bit closer to those answers.
All right, cool. Thanks, Christina.
Yeah, no problem.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.